Give me love. Give me peace on earth, sings George Harrison. Isn't that what we all want? Peace on earth. So how do we get there? Our guest today, the Reverend John Deere, says we get there by following the teachings of Jesus and Gandhi. Hello, folks. We are Solutions of Balance. We're happy you can join us today. You're listening to Forward Radio WFMP 106.5 FM. Solutions of Balance is a program of and sponsored by Forward Radio. The following is part of WFMP's public affairs educational programming. The views expressed are those of our guests and not that of the station, nor its board of directors. If you'd like to share your views, you can contact us at solutionsofbalance18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Our guest today is a nationally known author, Catholic priest, and political activist, Reverend John Deere. The event that featured John Deere was sponsored by the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University, Lowell's Earth and Spirit Center, and co-sponsored by the Lowell Fellowship of Reconciliation. The John Deere presentation occurred at St. Agnes Church in Louisville, April 14, 2024. Louisville's Corey Lockhart will introduce John Deere.
Good evening. I am delighted to introduce you to Father John Deere. Father John Deere is a world-renowned activist and author who currently teaches nonviolence and peace at the Beatitude Center in Morro Bay, California. A Nobel Peace Prize nominee, he works in the tradition of Dr. King and Gandhi for the nonviolent abolition of war, racism, the death penalty, poverty, environmental destruction, and nuclear weapons. He has worked closely with other peacemakers like Thich Nhat Hanh, Phil and Dan Berrigan, Mother Teresa, Martin Sheen, Joan Baez, Cesar Chavez, James Lawson, and Coretta Scott King. From 1998 to 2001, he served as executive director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation USA, the largest interfaith peace organization in the U.S. He co-founded Campaign Nonviolence, a national week of activism against war, poverty, environmental destruction, and racism. And he served on the staff of its host organization, Pace Bene. Father John was arrested during the 1993 Plowshares Action Against Nuclear Weapons in North Carolina and over 80 other times in acts of civil disobedience. He participated in the 2016 Vatican Conference on Nonviolence and Just Peace in Rome, and his contributions of background material for a speech by Pope Francis in 2017 marked the first statement on nonviolence in Catholic Church history. Father John's 35 books include Thomas Merton, Peacemaker, The Beatitudes of Peace, Jesus the Rebel, Seeds of Nonviolence, Mary of Nazareth, and his autobiography, A Persistent Peace. He'll speak today about his latest book, The Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. And so let's give a warm welcome to Father John Deere.
We begin the second part of the Solutions of Balance broadcast that features the Reverend John Deere, with John Deere explaining the events that led up to the crucifixion of Jesus, the resurrection, and how that resurrection and crucifixion was part of Jesus' life that also demonstrates Jesus' call for peace and nonviolence. Let's listen to John Deere's explanation.
Resurrection means for me having nothing to do with death. Not having a trace of death in you, which means not having a drop of violence in you, which means resurrection means total nonviolence. And you and I, if we dare practice active, creative, gospel, Gandhian, Kenyan nonviolence, what we're really doing is getting ready for resurrection. That's not what Matthew says. I really invite you to ponder that. It all makes sense to me. God affirms this life of ultimate nonviolence. And Jesus comes back and says, the last sentence of Matthew is amazing. Go make disciples of nonviolence of all the nations. That's your mission, folks. And you're looking at me like, oh, this guy. I'm sorry I'm going on and on, but I just can talk about him all night. Matthew, I think it is so funny because they killed the poor guy, and there's like these 10 sentences where the muckety-mucks and the horrible soldiers are going, well, this pox-Christi Catholic worker, Epiphany, passionist, earth, and spirit-centered group. They're bound to do, they're up to something. They're going to steal the body and say he rose from the dead. We better go talk to Pilate. And they go to talk to Pilate. They have a big confab. And Pilate goes, you're right. They're going to do something. So he orders the centurion himself to take 100 armed guards with big swords. And they stand all around the tomb to guard it. And they put the Roman imperial seal right on the stone. It's incredible. And it says in Latin, in three sentences, we killed you. You're dead. Now stay there. And Jesus breaks the law and rises from the dead. Resurrection is illegal. He commits civil disobedience all over again. And he's out and about today causing good trouble in his illegal movement. He's like, go to the scene next in the Garden of Gethsemane. Are you still okay with me going on ranting and raving like this about Jesus and nonviolence? Somebody said to me last week, why are you going around the country inflicting nonviolence on everybody? I said, somebody has to. You're just a bully for peace and nonviolence. I said, oh, thank you. That's so nice of you. Here come the horrible Roman soldiers. What? There's 100 of them. With all the muckety-mucks, the chief priests and the head of the scribes and the Pharisees, and they all have big swords. And what, there may be, let's say there's 50 people, let's be generous, in the Jesus movement. Men and women, his people in his community circle. And they're hiding out. They're an illegal movement. It's the middle of night. And they're in the Mount of Olives, which is on the hill before the valley, going over, and there's Jerusalem down there. And what is Peter thinking? Peter's thinking, if there's ever a just war in all of human history, if there's ever a moment to kill for God, in the name of God, when violence is divinely sanctioned, when we should kill for God's sake, it's now in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he's right. Our guy's in trouble. The Holy One's in trouble. They're going to get him. We've got to do something. So he takes up the sword, and just as he goes to kill, the commandment comes down. Dear friends, memorize these words with me. Put down the sword. Those are the last words of Jesus to the church. It's the last thing his best friends heard him say before he died. Think about it. I didn't make that up. It's right there in the Gospels. And it's the first time they understood how serious Jesus is about nonviolence. They sat through the Sermon on the Mount. They had 3 years of all-day-long retreats on nonviolence and universal love. That's all the poor guy's talking about. I go at length in the book to try to explain it. That's all he's talking about. And we just don't want to hear it. And you know, you read Luke, and he ups this even more. You know, people always say to me, what would you do if somebody came? I mean, you're going to intervene? I'm going, yeah, nonviolently. In Luke, it says Peter jumps in, and what happens? He cuts off the ear of the slave of the high priest. Of course, first of all, the poor servant of the high priest, he's just caught and being killed. The poor are always the victims of our war. But what would happen next? Now think it through. In like 3 seconds, those 100 drunken Roman soldiers who are bored to death are now getting the crazy lunatic are going to all pull out their swords. And what's about to happen in 5 seconds? A massacre. They're all going to be killed. And who knows how many of the Jesus community all have swords and are ready to kill. What does Jesus do? Study Luke. He steps into the fight and says, stop. No more of this. And he heals the poor man. And he saves everybody's life. Nobody is killed. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are adamant. They all left him over nonviolence. And Gandhi says Jesus goes to his death in meticulous nonviolence, just as the execution of Jesus is meticulously legal. Now, you know, we're in the Easter season, and the way I look at resurrection is, you know, well, there's so much to say about it. You know, I don't know about you, but having been, you know, raised a Jesuit, I think, well, what would I do if I were the savior of the world? Let's ponder that for a minute. The way we think. I came down and explained everything to you. I was really kind. I taught you universal love and total nonviolence and infinite compassion. And God is love and peace and compassion. And what did you do? You betrayed me and denied me and arrested me and abandoned me and ran away from me and brutally tortured me and brutally mocked me and executed me. And then I died. And I went up to God, and she said, I need you to go back down there. I go, I'm not going back down to those horrible people. And I'd be resentful and angry for about 5,000 years. We get resentful over the smallest things. Jesus comes back and makes breakfast for these people. I always joke, a little over the top with the nonviolence, Jesus. He's as gentle and peaceful as can be. That's why resurrection means for me having nothing to do with death. Not having a trace of death in you. Which means not having a drop of violence in you. Which means resurrection means total nonviolence. And you and I, if we dare practice active, creative, gospel, Gandhian, Kingian nonviolence, what we really doing is getting ready for resurrection. That's not what Matthew says. I really invite you to ponder that. It all makes sense to me. God affirms this life of ultimate nonviolence. And Jesus comes back and says, I mean, the last sentence of Matthew is amazing. Go make disciples of nonviolence of all the nations. That's your mission, folks. But Matthew, you're looking at me like, oh, this guy, I'm sorry I'm going on and on, but I just can talk about him all night. Matthew, I think it is so funny because they killed the poor guy, and there's like these 10 sentences where the muckety-mucks and the horrible soldiers are going, well, you know, this Pax Christi, Catholic worker, Epiphany, passionist, earth and spirit center group, they're bound to do, they're up to something. They're going to steal the body and say he rose from the dead. We better go talk to Pilate. And they go to talk to Pilate. They have a big confab. And Pilate goes, you're right. They're going to do something. So he orders the centurion himself to take 100 armed guards with big swords. And they stand all around the tomb to guard it. And they put the Roman imperial seal right on the stone. It's incredible. And it says in Latin, in three sentences, we killed you. You're dead. Now stay there. And Jesus breaks the law and rises from the dead. Resurrection is illegal. He commits civil disobedience all over again. And he's out and about today causing good trouble in his illegal movement. He's like, this guy's got to stop. This isn't, you don't like that? Mark has none of this. Mark doesn't even have resurrection. Mark has no infancy narrative, no Sermon on the Mount. It's real short. It's the earliest one written. Nearly all of Mark is in Matthew. And the word that appears over and over again is immediately. He got up and immediately went there, and he was messing around with those people he shouldn't have been. He broke the law. Then he immediately went over there. And it's just nonstop. That's why I call Mark a nonstop action thriller. No? You didn't like that? Okay, then here's what I really think. You're really not going to like this. Mark, you can memorize this with me. There's a call to radical discipleship to the total nonviolence of Jesus as permanent nonviolent resistance to the entire culture of violence, war, and death. Permanently, for the rest of your life, you stand up and resist the culture as your obedience to the God of peace, as your way of welcoming God's reign of peace, love, and nonviolence on earth. Discipleship requires permanent resistance, according to Mark's version. Just to say a word about Luke. Do I have time to say a word about Luke? Can I say three things that I haven't talked about, I think? Number one, I always wondered, where did Jesus get all this? I mean, he just like invented it. He's to say it stupidly, Jesus is a genius. Well, Luke gives us the answer. He got all his nonviolence from his mother. Mary doesn't say anything in Matthew or Mark, and she doesn't really come across well in Mark. If you read the fine print, she comes to take him away because he's clearly crazy and doesn't look good. And John, she's got one sentence. Remember at the wedding at Cana? Do you know what the... Huh?
Wedding at Cana.
What?
I was just going to say what he said.
The wedding at Cana. In the Greek, this is the way the actual wedding at Cana text goes in John. There was a wedding at Cana. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was there. Jesus and the disciples showed up. They ran out of wine. Mary was mortified. They went right to the bar and drank all the wine. It's right there. And Jesus is like, woman, my hour hasn't come yet. You're drinking all the wine. You didn't like any of that. But her one sentence is, do whatever he tells you, which is a pretty good sentence. Okay. Luke gives us the real story. The three spiritual movements of nonviolence. Okay? This is how Luke begins. Mary and the Annunciation as contemplative nonviolence. She's a person of total meditation and prayer. She just, it's all God all the time. And she has an experience of God, as you do. And as anyone, if you have an experience of God, the first thing that happens is you're terrified. Oh my God. And then you move to the second part, which is you're confused, which comes out in the fancy language that Mary uses to the angel. Uh-huh. And then it leads to, wait a second. Behold, I know who I am. I am the servant of the God of peace. Let it be done as whatever you say. I only do what the God of peace wants upon me. She knows who she is. It's all about her identity. If you want to practice nonviolence, there it is. And that experience of contemplative nonviolence, rooted in our fundamental identity as this servant of the God of peace, actually Jesus is even more generous and calls us the sons and daughters of the God of peace, if you're with me on this, leads to the second movement of nonviolence, according to Luke. Mary and the Visitation as active nonviolence, where you reach out and serve someone in need, in this case, Elizabeth. It's fantastic. She gets up and goes immediately to help her. And Elizabeth's first words are, who am I? Remember? It's like nobody knows who they are. Like, we don't know who we are. Mary knew, Jesus knew, and he calls us to know. And what do women who are involved in peace and justice work do? They start talking about God. Not about all the bad news. Because if you're involved in active nonviolence, you're going, you wouldn't believe what God did to me. Well, you wouldn't believe what God did to me. But blessed are you. No, blessed are you. Blessed is everybody. And then they get a little carried away. That's how this works. And the second movement of active nonviolence leads to the third. Mary and the Magnificat as prophetic nonviolence. Suddenly she becomes Jeremiah. My soul proclaims the greatness of the God of peace. You wouldn't believe all the great things God has done for me. And I see it now. God's mercy, God's active creative nonviolence, is from age to age. It's there in Abraham and Sarah and Moses and all the prophets. It's in the early church. I see it in Francis and Claire, the abolitionists, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, Gandhi's movement, the women's movement, the LGBT environmental movement, and the thousands of grassroots movements that are sweeping the planet is God. And she goes, I see it all. It's so darn exciting. God is throwing down the rulers from their thrones. Actually, I'm a little concerned about her nonviolence there. And lifting up the poor and filling the home hungry with good things. Do you see how exciting this is? That's the journey there in a nutshell. Contemplative to active to prophetic nonviolence. And so, Luke gives us Luke 4, where Jesus walks into the synagogue in Capernaum, just a little room with the rabbis. And he opens up the scroll of the most radical scripture in history, the last chapter, pure revolutionary nonviolence, and he reads it aloud and says, the Spirit of the God of peace is upon me to bring good news to all the poor of the earth, to liberate all the oppressed of the whole earth and their oppressors, to release all captives, to give vision to the blind, to the whole human race, because we're all blind, and to proclaim the Jubilee year. Today the scriptures are fulfilled in your hearing. The Jubilee year? Have you read the book of Leviticus? Who cares? It's this complicated thing, like every 7 years times 7 years on the 49th year plus one, on the last day of the seventh times seventh year, on December 31st, you gather all the money of the planet together. Wait a second. What? All the money on the planet is gathered together and redistributed equally toward every human being, all 8.5 billion people on January 1st. All the money of Bezos, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, he who must not be named, the generals, the war makers, the presidents, the tyrants, the dictators. Think about it. Every human being gets an equal amount of money starting January 1st so they have good food, clean water, plumbing, health care, housing, jobs, full education, and dignity. Friends, this is total revolutionary nonviolence. That's why Luke frames his gospel that in the synagogue, is it at Nazareth, Jesus throws down the gauntlet and announces, today in your hearing, I am launching the permanent, never-ending, bottom-up, grassroots revolution of nonviolence, which continues to this day. That's what you're doing here in Louisville. That's our job. And Luke, the rest of Luke is fulfilling that, and I'll just end with Luke 10, if you're okay. This will be my last thought, because I just love it so much. It's so detailed. He says, he turned and he sent 72 disciples ahead of him in pairs. Well, that's classic labor movement organizing. Because Jesus is a grassroots movement organizer. And he's organizing this campaign of nonviolence from Galilee to Jerusalem. Jesus thinks he's Gandhi. Jesus thinks he's Martin Luther King. Who does this guy think he is? The people in the cheap seats don't like that at all. I don't know who they are. They're not buying that. And he says, go on your way. I am sending you as, quote, lambs into the midst of wolves. Hello? That's his description of us. You're a total innocent lamb surrounded by about 100 starving wolves who are thinking, dinner time. That's your image of yourself, the way you're going to live for the rest of your life. You're not supposed to be like the wolves anymore, friends. You got to literally disarm your inner wolf. I thought that was pretty beautifully said, but apparently. Okay. Innocent as lambs, you speak to peace everywhere you go, and you do three things. This is the job description of the 72. You're to heal all the victims of violence. Well, that's everybody. That's what you're doing in Louisville. We're healing one another because we're all victims of this insane culture of violence. Secondly, you're to expel the demons of violence that are possessing people. That means you just go around Louisville and say, friends, you don't have to be possessed by the NRA anymore. You don't have to own guns and support gun violence in Kentucky or anywhere. You don't have to be possessed by the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or America or war or blessing the troops or the military. You're free of all of that in the new life of nonviolence. And the third, you are to proclaim the kingdom of God is at hand. I found this quote from Gandhi. Gandhi said, the kingdom of God is nonviolence. That's profound theology. Your job is to go out into Louisville and say, friends, the end of war is at hand. No more war, no more gun violence, no more racism, no more sexism, no more poverty, no more greed, no more fossil fuels, no more torture, no more executions, no more nuclear weapons, no more destruction of the creatures or creation, no more violence, no more death as a methodology of life. We are people of universal love and total nonviolence, but what's so exciting about Luke is it says, they come back rejoicing, as if they're going, wow, Jesus, this stuff works. And he's like, yeah, I told you. You're going to be fine. No harm is going to come to you because I've given you power. That's why Dr. King over and over defined nonviolence. He would say, nonviolence is power. The culture wants you to think you're powerless. There's nothing you can do. Who do you think you are? You can change the world? Yes, you have power. I saw Satan fall like lightning from the sky. Satan is code language in Mark and Luke for the empire. He can't come out and say it. But anytime people organize bottom-up movements, the empire falls. And so he says, don't rejoice because you have power over the demons. Rejoice because your names are written in heaven. So they rejoice, then he rejoiced. And then he starts praying and praising God and gets carried away. So the word joy is used 5 times. And I come to the conclusion, as I've studied the synoptics, it's the only time in the 4 Gospels where the poor guy is happy. Why? Because they did what he wanted. They joined the movement. If you want to practice nonviolence, you have to practice total nonviolence to yourself from now on. No violence to yourself. Don't beat yourself up. At the same time, number 2, meticulous interpersonal nonviolence toward everybody on the planet and the creatures and Mother Earth. And that's not enough. Number 3, you have to have 1 foot involved in Jesus' bottom-up people power grassroots campaign of nonviolence. Only we have to go farther than the abolitionists, farther than Gandhi, farther than Dr. King and all the movements of history. We have to become and build and create in Louisville and everywhere the largest, greatest global grassroots people power movement of nonviolence to stop all the wars and the destruction of Mother Earth. That's our mission. That's why Dr. King said the night before the government killed him, it's not violence or nonviolence. It's nonviolence or non-existence. This is the spiritual life. This is your task. And so I want to encourage you. Thank you for all the great good you do. You're doing great. And don't be discouraged. Don't give up. Keep at it, even though we're not going to live to see the victories we want. So we're sowing seeds of peace and justice for a future we won't live to see. Fine, we're part of the story, part of the Jesus grassroots movements. And when you're having bad days and you can't take it anymore, you say more prayers, you be with Jesus, you hold hands with your friends, you build community, and you keep going anyway. And even on the really bad days when you can't take it anymore and you want to give up, work for peace and justice anyway, just to make the poor guy happy. Thanks for listening. It's like 9:30. I'm so sorry. Any comments, questions, rebuttal, compliments? Oh, 8:30. He only talked for 1.5 hours. No comment, question? Yeah, go ahead.
I've been waiting to ask this question or to make this suggestion. I can be loud enough. I want to make this.
I want to ask John Deere to, Father John Deere to, I want to make a suggestion. I agree that we are all insane in terms of living in a climate or culture of violence, and we need more of a process to work us through that. And so my suggestion is, and I know that he is familiar with the Jesuit process of living out one's vocation with the spiritual exercises. So my suggestion is to focus on setting up spiritual exercises for nonviolence. And we can go to the your retreat house for it. You know,
at least a month.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
I will, I'll carry around the mic.
Thank you. So I'm asking people to come to the microphone because we're recording this for the radio, and that's the way the radio can pick it up. So my name is Jim Johnson. I grew up a Methodist, the Methodist Church, and I now attend a Catholic church. And I wondered, why was it that Jesus was accused of a crime? I didn't understand. What was the crime? What did he do? Mark Klansky, historian, his book Nonviolence, The History of a Dangerous Idea, explains it. And the reason he was accused of a crime was because he was a pacifist. And the Roman political leadership thought they could not enforce Roman law without violence. Jesus was not the only person they hung on the cross, just about anybody who disagreed with the political leadership. So they thought they could not protect the Roman Empire or expand the Roman Empire without an army. And so this Christian thing was spreading because of Jesus' teaching. And because Christians were pacifists in those days, they did follow Jesus' teachings. And so the Roman Empire was, the political leadership was terribly worried about the fact that they could not protect the Roman Empire without violence. Too many people turning pacifist. So that was the sin that, according to Klansky, that Jesus had committed against the state. So he was hung on the cross, we all know. The Romans, Christians, were made to practice their religion in the catacombs, out of sight and out of mind, because the Roman political leadership were afraid. So that continued for 300 years. So Marcus Aurelius and then Constantine, Marcus Aurelius, the emperor at that time, 312 AD, Constantine, the Roman general, decided he wanted to be the emperor. He controlled some of the army, not enough to defeat Marcus Aurelius. So he went to the Christian leadership. And as Father John Deere explained, the Christians decided to join Constantine's army. And Constantine promised, look, if we win the conflict, win war, I become emperor, then Christianity will become legal. Not only will Christianity become legal, I will build you churches. Here is Roman slavery and Roman money, taxes to build churches. So that's the reason why Christians agreed to join his army. And as we all know, he did win that conflict. Constantine became the leader of the ancient Roman Empire. And true to his word, he built churches, declared Christianity legal. And according to Mark Klansky here, that established an efficacious relationship between the church and the state. An efficacious relationship that still exists today. So I'm wondering, is that efficacious relationship that exists between the church and the state, is that the reason why so many Christians, or whenever there's a war, Christians get behind? They support the war, they support the U.S. political leadership, American exceptionalism takes over, flag and country and God all put together, and we all march off to war. So my question is it partially anyway because of the efficacious relationship that still exists between the church and the state? Free taxes for the church? What do you think?
You're not asking me to answer that, are you? No. I was wondering if you could speak a little more of that. You said Jesus had joy and grief, because I probably not alone, I have a lot of grief about this culture of death in the world. And so that's kind of a new thing for me to think about Jesus continually having joy and grief together.
You haven't thought about it that way?
Not entirely, no. Yeah.
Did you all hear what she said? She asked me to say a little more about grief and joy. I hadn't thought of it that way either, but I had been reading the Sermon on the Mount. And you'll forgive me for name dropping, but I met Tutu in the 80s and then again in the 90s. You know, and I had invited all the Nobel Peace Prize winners to go to Iraq on an all-expense-paid trip. And I came and spoke with Gene Edwards and the FOR in Louisville about that, I think, afterwards. God bless Gene. And But then Tutu asked me to start writing to him, and so we wrote every week for 20 years or something on emails. We were good friends. He called me his pen pal. Now, there were two things happened, and I'm trying to give you your answer. Now, the way I put it, and I put this in my book, The Nonviolent Life, that the emotional life of Jesus, if you look at these teachings as just not pious platitudes, but actual practical instructions, like directions on how to set up your refrigerator. You have to follow the directions, and none of us do that. It's okay, don't get angry, and don't be afraid. Well, those are our best things. What are you talking about? But do grieve and rejoice. Well, who does that? You remember I was supposed to be having breakfast with my parents. We had reservations on September 11th in the second World Trade Tower in the dining room at the top. My mother canceled it the night before we had mass with Daniel Berrigan, because she didn't want me to have to take the subway all that far down. So we had breakfast on the top of another building, and they left town, and I immediately went down to help. And by chance met the head of the Red Cross, who asked me to coordinate all the chaplains, and I was right in it. And I started working 2 days a week, 24/7 for 3 months, at Ground Zero, and then quite 600 chaplains ministering to 50,000 relatives. And I could talk a lot about that. But everybody in New York, which is a very violent place, I mean, you walk down the street, and the idea is you're not supposed to look another person in the eye. But suddenly, everybody was like, are you okay? Did you lose somebody? Because everybody knew somebody who knew somebody. It was very weird. And we didn't know if they were going to drop nuclear bombs, if you think about it, because the city shut down, the subways closed, the bridges closed, so millions of people were walking. And then these jets started swooping down over Central Park. I was walking, I saw it. Everybody was scared, like, what's next? So suddenly, everybody got compassionate. It was incredible. It lasted for 2 weeks, and George W. Bush had to stop it. So we went on the National Cathedral, you remember? And said, you don't have to grieve anymore. Go shopping. And immediately it stopped. It was palpable. So I'm just going to tell you a story. In 2006, 10 Nobel Peace Prize winners were hosted in Denver for a week, and they were each allowed to bring one person, a spouse or assistant. My friend is Mairead McGuire from Belfast, so I was there with the Dalai Lama and Tutu and everybody. There were 20 of us, and we had the whole top floor of the Marriott in Denver, and we lived together for a week. And one day they spoke to 25,000 people in the stadium, the next day they spoke to 10,000 young people in the arena, the next day 5,000 women in the opera house, and the next day they were filmed by the BBC in an interview that was seen by 1.5 billion people. It was a great week. And so we're in the stadium. And you know how the camera, and we're waiting to go out. They're going to go out on the stage. And we're in a circle in the green room and couches. And here's the Dalai Lama and Tutu and Rigoberta Menchu. And we're all sitting there. We're kind of friends then. We're talking. And you know how the conversation gets quiet, and there's suddenly a lull in the conversation. And the Dalai Lama turns to Tutu and says to him, Tutu, you have the biggest mouth in the whole world, and you're driving us all crazy. We should have killed you a long time ago, and someone should kill you, and it might as well be me. With that, he lunges at Tutu and grabs Tutu by the neck, and Tutu is going, oh, and then he puts his tongue out, and then Tutu falls on the floor, and then the Dalai Lama falls on the floor, and we all look at him, horrified, and they're on the floor, and their hands are on their stomachs, and their feet are up in the air, and their eyes are closed, and their mouths are open, and they're laughing so hard, no noise is coming from them. And just then, the guy comes out and says, you're on. And they get up and they go. And I remember thinking, I want to be like that. I knew Tutu. The poor guy told me. He was under death threat every day of his life since he was 13. Now, he should have been a raging, angry lunatic.
My friend Thich Nhat Hanh knew 1,000 monks in Vietnam killed by American bombs, and he knew them by name. He should have been insane. His brother was killed, Thich Nhat Hanh, and he took to his bed for 3 months. And the guy had more peace and joy than anybody I've ever known. I remember being with him shortly before he had a stroke. And spent a day with him in this hermitage, and he... I remember thinking, well, this is what it was like to be with Gandhi, to be with Jesus, and I have to somehow try to teach people. I don't know how to describe it. So before, I knew Tutu was very sick, so I go to South Africa to see him. Have I told you this before? Have you heard all this? This is like, I don't know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and I get there, and I'm in Cape Town, and I get in a room, and I'm in so much trouble in the U.S. The Jesuits hate me, and the bishops are banning me. And he has catered a meal in my honor and brought all these his whole family to meet me. You know? And I get in the room and he grabs him by the collar, his little tiny coat, and he goes, John. I go, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. You better work for peace and justice till the day you die. And I went, oh, man. How am I going to do that? You call him Arch. Arch, and I hit him. And he hits me and goes, I said, how do you do that? Who do you think you are? Tutu? You know, this is the way we talked to one another. It was so much fun. And then he got real close in my face. He's about this tall and he goes, I said to him, how do you do that? And it launched a whole mythic day in my life. He said, I cry. And he bursts into tears. And he falls into my arms, sobbing. And he says, John, I cry every day since I was 5 because they don't get it. We're all sisters and brothers in each other, the whole planet. It's so obvious they don't see what you and I see, that we just love one another. And think about how much suffering God has to go through, because God is, you don't know anything about nonviolence, John. To be not totally nonviolence, God, and he launches into this big theology and he's sobbing. God has to give us total free will, otherwise it's coercive. And therefore, every human being has rejected nonviolence, and we're killing each other, and I cry every day, and then he regroups, and he goes, and I laugh, and seeing you, and he bursts out laughing, he goes, you're the most ridiculous person I know. To which I said, I'll have you know I am 52 years old. Tutu, and he goes, oh, you're just a big baby. You're ridiculous. And he's laughing his head off. It was so much fun. Again with the grief and the joy. And I remember thinking, this went on for a couple hours. It was mythic for me. And I think I mentioned it at the beginning of the book because I learned. I remember thinking, because I've been studying the Sermon on the Mount. Oh, right, I forgot. He lives according to the Sermon on the Mount. So he practices grief and joy. What I'm trying to say is there's another way that we have not figured out in America. Dr. King got it, and his friends got it. Dan and Phil got it. Gandhi certainly got it. I'm not sure about Dorothy. I hope she did, but she was a very angry person. But she didn't mean to be. She just was hurt so much. But what I'm saying is, you can change the world without being consumed with anger and spending your whole life as a raging lunatic and being afraid. And I don't think you'll get very far. These great people were changing the world, and they were not, they had gone to some other different place. And I think it was grief and joy. They were practicing the Sermon on the Mount way. So you see, Jesus gets to Jerusalem, and what happens at the end of Luke? He breaks down sobbing. He sees it, if only they had learned the things that make for peace. And he's sobbing. Now, what's so instructive there is, number one, that's our position. From now on, we grieve with the grieving Jesus, and Jerusalem has become the whole planet. You've rejected my way of nonviolence, and so you're going to be destroyed. Well, now the whole world is Jerusalem, and we're about to destroy the whole planet. So we are grieving, and we want to be conscious about it. And lament with Jesus. But unlike Jesus, you and I move in depression and despair and give up. Oh, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm going to walk away from the movement or the church because it's all horrible and you can't move. It's exactly what the culture wants you to do. And that's not the grief of Jesus, because when
Jesus to Tutu to Dorothy to Dr. King are grieving, it breaks their heart, which makes their heart wider and even more compassionate and more loving toward everybody, which leads to action. So instead of getting up, Jesus weeps. I didn't even say this. He does two actions. The second is the civil disobedience in the temple. The first is incredible street theater based on Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. This is what happens if you do grief and joy. He gets on a donkey and rides into Jerusalem. But what's so incredible is that Pilate is coming in on the war horse with 600 armed soldiers. And this chapter 9 of the book of Zechariah, verse 9 and 10, he must have read that as a kid and said, I'm going to do that. Because how is it? It says, see, here comes your Savior, humble and meek, totally nonviolent, riding on a donkey. And he comes to break the war bow and the war shield and the war chariot, all the weapons of war he's going to destroy, and his reign of peace will be from the ends of the earth to the ends of the earth and will never end. That's action. If you live grief and joy, if you give into anything else, worry, anxiety, all the stuff Jesus talks about, you won't be useful. Does that help?
Yeah.
Other comments or questions? Or have we resolved everything? I think we've resolved everything. He's had enough. Well, I am happy to sign books. I really thank you for getting the book. There's tons of them. I have another 100 in the car. I have my other books on that table and some flyers about my work. I really invite you to sign up for my project, beatitudecenter.org. Beatitudecenter.org. And I do all these great Zooms every 2 weeks with people like Cornel West and Helen Prejean and Jim Lawson. And it's really great, and you'd love it. And thanks for listening and having me. And arise and walk forth, everybody. God bless you all.
Listeners, we're out of time. Our guest today has been the Reverend John Deere. Our program that featured John Deere will air again April 23rd at 8 a.m. and April 24th at 6 a.m. You can listen live stream by visiting our website at forwardradio.org and clicking on Listen Live Now. The Solutions of Balance program featuring John Deere will be placed in our archives. To listen via our archives, just visit our website at forwardradio.org, scroll down to Program Archives, that features John Deere, Part 2. Please respond to us with your thoughts and suggestions by visiting us at solutionsofbalance18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today's Solutions of Balance program is the first in a two-part series that features John Deere. We'd like to thank the Bellarmine Thomas Merton Center, Louisville's Earth and Spirit Center, and Louisville's Fellowship of Reconciliation for sponsoring the event that featured John Deere. Before we leave you today, we'd like to take a minute to thank those who have supported WFMP Radio and Solutions of Balance. April 13th, WFMP 106.5 FM Radio celebrated 7 years of broadcasting. Without your generous gift, WFMP 106.5 FM Radio could not exist. As most of our listeners know, WFMP FM Radio is a non-commercial radio station, and we depend on you, our listeners, and your generous gifts. You can donate at any time. Just go to forwardradio.org and click on Donate. Your support is greatly appreciated. Also, this week, WFMP 106.5 FM Radio's Access Hour will feature Farah Mukhtarzadeh. Farah Mukhtarzadeh appeared on the Access Hour as the keynote speaker of the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation's Third Thursday Lunch. Dr. Farah Mukhtarzadeh has acquired her doctorate in feminine Islamic studies, has spent years traveling through Middle East countries, including Tanzania, Lebanon, Turkey, and Iran. Farah Mukhtarzadeh clearly explains the history of Iran, including the many changes in government and the impact that came as a result of U.S. intervention in Iranian political and economic affairs. Farah Mukhtarzadeh now lives in Louisville and is the founder and co-founder of the Louisville Palestinian Israeli ceasefire coalition. The Access Hour that will feature Vera Moltanizetti will air Wednesday, April 24th at 2 p.m., Thursday, April 25th at 11 a.m., and Friday, April 26th at 1 p.m. Vera Moltanizetti's explanation of the Iranian history is an informative and fascinating presentation. You don't want to miss Vera Moltanizetti's presentation. For Solutions to Violence Radio, I'm Jim Johnson. Our editor is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. Thanks for listening.
Keep me free from birth. Give me hope. Help me cope.